I'm Randy Hahn, and you're listening to another podcast from Teal Town, USA.
Hello, and welcome to another Teal Town Conversation here on TealTownUSA.com. I am Eric Kura. You can follow me on Twitter at PuckGuy14. Joining me today is AJ Strong, and with us today, we've been wanting this, we've been ready for this. We are truly honored to have Sharks Television play-by-play voice Randy Hahn with us. Randy, hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Thank you for joining us. Hope your off-season's been well.
It's been good. It's been busy. Starting to get excited about the season. September, of course, is the month when vacations end and training camps start and schedules come out. And so slowly but surely getting ready for October 4th.
Awesome. The, what is it, 26th anniversary of the Sharks' first ever game, for sure. So, all right, we'll kind of start off kind of flashbacking a little bit before we get into the team here. Of course, you were part of the group that convinced the owners and the NHL to come to San Jose. Can you kind of tell us the timetable from that first meeting at House of Pizza to when the Sharks skated out on the ice for the first time?
Well, it was a long and winding road, but it kind of goes back to the late 80s, early 90s. And I was at that time actually working for the Los Angeles Kings, doing their pregame and intermission and postgame shows on Prime Ticket, which went away for a while. Now it's actually back again. But it was the television broadcast when Wayne Gretzky was with the Kings. But I was living in San Jose, so I was kind of commuting between San Jose and L.A. and heard about a group that was going to meet at the House of Pizza to talk about bringing an NHL team to San Jose. This was after the city had successfully won the election to build what was then San Jose Arena. So I decided to show up at that House of Pizza meeting. And there was kind of primarily a group of hockey fans that didn't really know, in my opinion, how quite they wanted to go about this. And there were talks about, you know, picketing City Hall and you know, stuff like that. And there was a group of attorneys there, two or three lawyers. And I kind of, we got off to the side of the table and said, let's take a different approach to this. And what we did was we formed a California nonprofit corporation. At that time, we called it NHL Hockey San Jose. And our goal was to try and go about this in a more business-like manner, try and inform the rest of the NHL about this new arena and the potential for expansion in Silicon Valley, because I think at that time, a lot of people in the NHL thought expansion would mean going to the city of San Francisco or maybe even Oakland. But this, with the new arena, offered an opportunity to think outside of those boundaries. So we wanted to A, educate, B, try and bring together a group of hockey supporters in the Bay Area, not necessarily just in the South Bay, but maybe primarily, bring them together as a group to kind of form the skeleton, if you will, of a season ticket base, and then use that education and group of people together to try and attract some ownership from investors that might be interested in coming up with the many millions of dollars that it would cost to get an NHL expansion franchise. So we went about it that way. We worked hard at educating. We put together a package that, because I was already working in the NHL and traveling with the Kings, I had access to a lot of people in the league and, you know, just talked to a lot of people and showed them information about the city and about the new arena and about the demographics of Silicon Valley and things like that. And then we would go to, 49er games, Raider games. We would go to NHL preseason games in Oakland back in the day when they had those. And we would put flyers on windshields under wiper blades, you know. Here's this group, NHL Hockey San Jose, pay $20, sign up. We'll send you a newsletter. We'll send you a T-shirt. We'll keep you informed on this effort to try and bring the NHL to San Jose. And I think our group got up to about 8,000 or 10,000 people eventually. So that was a nice group of people that were interested in what we were doing. And that actually ended up becoming the original season ticket mailing list to some degree when they actually went out and you know, had the franchise and tried to get people to make commitments to tickets. So that was great because a lot of those people who were involved at the very beginning got an opportunity to get great season tickets at the beginning. And I meet them all the time, you know, people who were there from the Cow Palace days and those are some of those people. So eventually we attracted some interest in ownership from Howard Baldwin, who, if you Google him, was a WHA owner with the Hartford Whalers. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Hartford Whalers eventually were one of the WHA teams that were taken into the NHL as part of, you know, the WHA going out of business, but they were absorbed along with the Edmonton Oilers and Winnipeg Jets back in those days and Quebec Nordiques. And Baldwin had a new business partner, and they were interested in doing this. And they met with the mayor, Tom McHenry, who now was on our side as well with this effort. And they hammered out an agreement to have exclusive rights to the new arena to bring the NHL to San Jose. Then at the kind of 11th hour, the Gunn family entered the picture. They owned the Minnesota North Stars at that time. They were looking to sell the Minnesota North Stars, and they wanted the Bay Area market for themselves. And as existing owners, I think they had a little more leverage, a little more power, a little more in the way of connections with the commissioner, et cetera. And they brokered a deal where they sold the North Stars to Howard Baldwin in exchange for the rights to San Jose. Oh, and lo and behold, that's how the Sharks came to be. And that's how they came to be owned by George Gunn.
Well, nice. What convinced you that like San Jose would be the right place versus, as you mentioned earlier, like San Francisco or Oakland? I mean, obviously you did have the new facility, the new San Jose arena there, but is there something that said, no, San Jose is the right place to put this?
Well, I think number one was Silicon Valley and the fact that this valley was transforming and it was becoming a technology hub. And you have to remember, this is late 80s, early 90s. I mean, the internet was kind of a rumor back then. So we're talking way, way back when companies like Yahoo were just starting, just getting on board. But you could already tell that it was going to be transformative for this area. And there was going to be commerce. There was going to be population. And a lot of those people were going to come from areas that had a hockey tradition, East Coast, Eastern Canada. People were moving to this area who had hockey in their background. So I think all of those things combined, along with the fact that what else was going on at that time was the Warriors had not renovated the Oakland Coliseum Arena yet. They wanted it renovated. They wanted it fixed up for their needs, and it wasn't going well. So they used the existence of the new arena in San Jose as leverage, and they threatened to move to San Jose. And we never thought the Warriors ever were going to move to San Jose. We thought they were just using it to get what they wanted in Oakland, which, in fact, is what they did. And we convinced Tom McHenry that, you know, you've got a way better shot here to have something for San Jose. And this is nothing to take away from the Earthquakes who were around before that. In fact, when I was broadcasting in the North American Soccer League for the Edmonton Drillers and later the San Diego Sockers, I was doing, you know, games against the Earthquakes all the time. But, you know, in all fairness, the NASL or Indoor Soccer League back in those days was not on par with the major league sports like baseball, football, basketball, or the NHL. So San Jose really never had a major league team of its own. And the other ammunition we had was that a high percentage of season ticket holders back in the late 80s, early 90s for the 49ers and the Giants were South Bay residents who were commuting to those games. And we were able to present those statistics, and it showed that there was a rabid fan base for sports in the South Bay, but they didn't really have a team they could call their own. And this would be a chance for San Jose to be on the map with a franchise of its own, and it would be a lot easier for the fans to get there. And, you know, those are just some of the factors that we thought were conducive for San Jose having its own team. And, you know, it turned out on some of those things we were right.
Yeah, and it's funny you bring up those technology companies because Eric and I were talking not too long ago that, you know, where were you when it was screensaver night at the Shark Tank? Yeah. But I know when you do these interviews and whatnot, you'll usually get the what's your most favorite call or your most memorable call during your time with the Sharks. And I actually would like to know what you think is your quirkiest call, and a couple obvious ones come to mind, whether it's Boyle's own goal versus Colorado in the playoffs, Nabby's power play goal in Vancouver, or Mark Bergevin throwing the puck into his own net back in St. Louis. What to you is like maybe your quirkiest call?
Yeah, well, that would probably be one of those, and because it was a playoff game, Bergevin throwing the puck into his own net, and then the Sharks ending up winning that series in a seventh game against, I'm pretty sure, St. Louis were the President's Trophy that year. So that was crazy, and it kind of took a little while to figure it out, because it just, how did the puck end up in the net? You know, it was just so bizarre. And that would probably be right at the top of the weirdest goals, quirkiest goals, if you will, that I ever called, because it was such an important goal.
Definitely. As we get closer and closer to the current Sharks, is there a favorite story you can share among your broadcast partners, whether it was Stem Kowski or Conroy, Chris Collins, Drew, or Marty?
About those guys?
Or just involving them, whether it was on air or something.
There's so many funny stories over the years with all those guys. And, you know, Pete Stemkowski was, you know, old school hockey, and he had a penchant for talking with his hands. Phones moving when we were on the air. And I think there was one occasion where I just turned to him in the middle of one of his rants. We were wearing headsets, so he didn't have a microphone in his hand. And he's going like, well, the Sharks have got to do this and that. And I kind of moved out of the way. And I said, he's now bringing a flight into San Jose Airport, you know, with his direction. But, you know, he was a character, and, I think I've had five or six different color commentators, but obviously Stemkowski was one of the long timers. Steve Conroy was around for a while, but the other two longest would, of course, be Drew Amenda and now Jamie Baker. And Drew and I had just all kinds of crazy stories. Unfortunately, most of them were so funny because they're not repeatable on the air. So what happens in the broadcast booth stays in the broadcast booth. Of course, some funny things did happen on the air over the years, and Drew and I had an ability to make each other laugh a lot, which subsequently made the viewer laugh a lot, mm-hmm. to the point sometimes where we were probably overdoing it, and occasionally we're told that we were overdoing it. But we had an awful lot of fun together on the air, and you know, I think the fans did too, because if you were a longtime viewer of the Hahn-Remenda combination, you almost felt like you were part of the broadcast crew, because we always looked at it as a three-person broadcast, Drew, me, and the viewer. And, you know, if you watched regularly, you were in on the inside jokes, and you knew what we meant when we said certain things that might not be obvious to the first-time viewer and things like that.
Well, just before the 2006-2007 season, Remenda did leave to go work for CBC, and Marty McSorley was brought in to do color that season. However, it was weird. During the second round of the playoffs versus the Red Wings, Remenda returned while McSorley kind of mysteriously vanished. And there's been so many rumors that have swirled about what happened. Can you provide any insight, or is it just personal reasons and he moved on?
It was personal, personnel, whatever you want to call it. I was just told one day that Marty was gone, and obviously there's background and backstories to all that, but we'll leave those sealed up and, you know, under the guise of confidentiality. It's just the things that there, nothing was said to explain it for a good reason. Put it that
way. Got it.
Very good. Okay. I always chalked it up to Remenda took his Pepsi with them.
Of course, one of the most memorable things, I think you, Drew, and I think Brody came in later, was do Sharks Late Night Confidential, where you guys would just kind of dive a little deeper into that game. And I think for part of us, through the evolution of Technology After Dark and now Teal Town After Dark, we kind of like embrace that a little bit. Would you ever consider bringing it back, whether like it was an Instagram story or Facebook Live now with all the technology being around?
You know, possibly. In the days when we did it, it was a very organic thing that we just thought up one day. I thought up one day. We shot it on our phone. It was informal. It was in the hotel, usually after the game, or I think one episode I did in my truck out in the parking lot and whatever. And, you know, in all honesty, Late Night Confidential, it was late night, but there wasn't really anything confidential. It wasn't revealing franchise secrets or talking about injuries or things like that. But I'll be honest with you, team management back in those days didn't like the show. And social media was in its infancy. And I think that's why it was a little bit alarming to maybe more conservative business people. They didn't get it. I felt like I got social media right away, and I felt that something like that would take off, and it did. Nothing I've done online has ever equaled the popularity of that segment that Drew and I did, and Brody was involved as well, and others. But that management they're not around anymore. But the people in charge at that time wanted to change a lot of it. They didn't like some of the things we said. Something as simple as saying, you can't use the word Costco because they're not a team sponsor, that kind of thing. And then beyond. And it just got to the point where it was changing. They made us stop. They took it offline. Then they allowed us to bring it back, but then it wasn't the same. And then the same things kept coming up about, you can't do this, you can't do that. It wasn't embraced. It was, it became a problem. Yeah. And because of that, I stopped doing it. Ironically, within the last 2 years, I was asked to revive it. It just doesn't feel the same anymore. It was a new thing then. I think it might be a little bit tired now, under another format, perhaps. But at this point, we're moving on to other things.
Yeah, I think that was a missed opportunity. I think you guys could have made a ton of money selling Sharks Late Night Confidential branded bathrobes. I think that would have been fantastic. We talked earlier about the beginnings that the Sharks had and how they came here in those first two seasons at the Cal Palace. And now we have the Vegas Golden Knights, the first new NHL team in 16 years. And we all know the Sharks had a couple of somewhat forgettable seasons at the Cal Palace before moving to the San Jose Arena and having that magical third season, knocking off a team that many had predicted to win the cup that year. Do you think the Knights will see success far faster than the Sharks? Or do you think the Knights should have had to go through the same process when it comes to drafting and everything that the Sharks had to do back when they came in?
Well, the Sharks coming in wasn't traditional either, because when the Sharks came in, they should have been given the number one overall draft pick, which was the tradition in the NHL that year. However, the number one overall draft pick that year happened to be Eric Lindros, a franchise generational player in most people's minds. And he's in the Hall of Fame, so you can't really argue with that. And they changed the rules and allowed Quebec to take him and allowed the Sharks to have that kind of cross-pollination draft with the Minnesota North Stars. And in some ways, that jump-started the Sharks, because you look at some of the players that came out of that, they ended up being important in establishing the Sharks in those first 2 years and helping them get to the playoffs and knock off Detroit in year three. So I don't know what will happen to the Vegas Knights. I think that they benefited from the fact that, well, they paid for it. They paid $500 million for their franchise, and I think they were willing to pay $500 million for their franchise if they got some kind of a boost, some kind of a push at the draft, some sort of a head start. And they didn't get the chance to draft first overall, but they got a lot of other rules changed and benefits of being able to draft off everyone else's roster, and the protection rules were made stricter so that better players were available. And I don't have any problem with that. I think if you're going to go into a non-traditional market like Las Vegas, you better make sure that team, as best you can, doesn't suck for 10 years, because they're not going to be there for 10 years. I'm telling you right now, if Vegas misses the playoffs 10 years in a row, they're going to move. That's a fact. And they'll struggle, and it'll become a joke. And that's not what you want. So I think you're better served as a league to pool resources together. In my mind, one of the frustrating things with the NHL over the years, and less so lately under Bettman's leadership, but before that, it wasn't a league with 30 teams. It was 30 individual businesses looking to do the best they could to obviously win, but if they had to screw the other 29, they didn't care. And that's not a good way to run a league. And then that's changed a lot under Bettman, and people don't give him enough credit for that, for the NHL being a far better league as far as the way it runs as a business and an equal partnership for all the teams in the league. And I think it's smart for the other 30 teams to agree to give Vegas a better head start because, if Vegas is successful, it will benefit all the other 30 teams in the NHL. It's just good business when it comes time to negotiating TV rights and other sponsorship deals than ever. If you have a strong league, teams 1 through 31, that's a better thing than having a bunch of problem franchises.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Over the course of the time the Sharks have been in the Bay Area, when did you first notice the Sharks fans being, holding the team accountable rather than just be more excited to have just a team? When did they stop seeing shoot? Well, we really don't stop screaming shoot anytime, but when they have the puck on the power play. But when did you start notice that the fans were starting to help the team a little more accountable?
Well, I guess the question you're asking is when did the love affair kind of fade away of the team just actually being here and, fans become more critical? That probably happened at about the year 5 or 6 mark. We missed the playoffs the first 2 years. And the second year, the last year at the Cow Palace, the team went 11-71-2. I mean, it was horrible. It was one of the worst records in the history of the NHL for a team and just brutally long losing streaks and everything else. And it was great that the first year the team moved to San Jose, they made the playoffs and beat Detroit, because had they missed the playoffs a third year in a row and then maybe a fourth, all of a sudden now you got trouble. You're in a new building and you've got a team that isn't getting better. And that was a big turning point for the team itself, for the franchise to get into the playoffs in year 3 and then make the playoffs again the very next year and win that that marathon overtime game against Calgary in game 7, and then unfortunately got swept by the Red Wings in the second round. But still, there was a tradition established there that this was going to be a team that was going to be in the playoffs. And for the most part, this is a franchise that since year 3 has been in the playoffs almost every year, and not many teams can say that over a 25-year stretch. So I think it was probably maybe in year 5 or 6 when the fans, okay, you're in the playoffs, but now we want to see you go further in the playoffs. And I think that's when the accountability comes in. The fan knowledge, I felt the knowledge of the fans was even there in year 3 as we started to show that we might be good enough to be a playoff team. And, you still, the flip side of it is even today, and I think about this every time I go on the air, every time I'm on the air, there's somebody watching us that's never seen a Sharks game before or has never seen a hockey game before. And we have to respect that. We can't just assume everybody knows everything. And that wouldn't be the case if I was doing the play-by-play of the Montreal Canadiens.
Yeah.
Everybody does know the game, and they all grew up with it, and they all lived it and breathed it from the time they were old enough to speak and walk and skate and hold a stick. But that's not the way it is here. So you have a lot of people that are finding out about the game later on, whether they're in their teens or they're young adults, or they might be retired and looking to get into something to pass their time, and they might discover hockey. And you have to respect that and understand that you're explaining the game to them too, at the same time as hoping not to insult people who have a vast knowledge of the sport. That's a fact for us in a market like San Jose. We have to address it. We have to be cognizant of that fact that not everybody knows what icing is right away. You and I, all three of us know it, and it's human. It's just our nature to know what it is. Right. But we still have to respect that some people are trying to learn the game from us. But, I think that the overall knowledge base of Sharks fans, it got very serious very early. By year 3, people knew what was going on, and they knew when the ref missed a bad call.
Well, and I remember several times seeing a Sharky on the Jumbotron kind of explaining, what some of the calls were and, what the officials were doing. Now, going into this coming season, are you surprised, or do you have any thoughts about this offseason that the Sharks haven't made a whole lot of movement, with the exception of course, extending Jones and Vlasic? What do you expect from the Sharks this year? Are there certain young guys that you think are going to be a bigger story, whether it be a LeBanc or a Meyer or a Sorensen?
Well, first of all, you left out another extension, Brent Burns.
Doesn't everybody know about that?
Dang it. Yeah.
I think Doug Wilson had a real challenging offseason to try and get those three guys all signed up and locked up and you know, doing his best to sort out the Marlowe Thornton situation. And, I mean, you've got the core of one of the best cores in the NHL going into the season. You've got a guy who I think he's on the doorstep of being an elite goalie. He might not be there quite yet because part of being elite is body of work and consistency, especially at the goaltending position, because we've seen guys who have been flashes in the pan at that position and won the Calder Trophy, and then all of a sudden they fall off the face of the map 2 years later because they lose their game. But I don't think Martin Jones is like that. I think he's, you know, the real deal, and I think he's about to move into that elite echelon of goaltenders in the NHL. So you've got that. You've got the elite offensive forward in the NHL, or at least one of the top two or three, along with Erik Karlsson in Brent Burns. So you've got that locked up for the next 8 years. You've got Marc-Edouard Vlasic, an elite shutdown defenseman who I think still has offensive abilities that we haven't seen all of yet, that we very well may even this season. He's locked up for the next 8 years. And, you know, that's a solid core, along with Pavelski and Couture. And you have a number of those guys locked up for the next several years, and you've got a real good core of your hockey team. So, you know, that's a great thing to start with. There's a lot of teams in the league that wish they had a franchise goalie and two franchise defensemen. Yep. That's the hardest thing to do. So, you know, defensively and in goal, I think we're a really solid hockey team. Now, the other side of it is scoring and power play. That is a big part of scoring. And I think those are two areas that last year the Sharks faltered offensively. They didn't get the kind of production out of some players that they needed. And guys like Tomas Hertl and Jonas Donskoy and Yannick Hansen, although he didn't have the whole season here, I think he's capable of much more offense than he had even in Vancouver last year. And, of course, it was a year with injury and from what we saw in him. And Mikhail Butker, I mean, this is the guy who's got – the most potential to, you know, far outdo his numbers from last year based on his career track record. And then you've got these younger players, some of which you've mentioned, but, you know, Donskoy needs to bounce back. He needs to be more like year one than he was last year as far as absolute production. And then Timo Meier, you know, he'll now have an opportunity to start the season in the NHL. He'll have to earn that job just like everybody else. And then there's always that guy who comes into camp who you didn't think was going to have the camp he has. And who knows? Is that Ryan Carpenter? Is that Danny O'Regan? You know, is that Marcus Sorensen? You know, do these guys jump to another level now? And does Joel Ward come back off surgery and come back to have the kind of year that he had in his first year with the Sharks as opposed to last year when his numbers were down? And some combination of all those guys, or maybe one really taking another step, maybe it's Melker Karlsson, I don't know who it'll be, is going to have to make up for the 27 goals that Patrick Marleau scored last year that aren't there on the roster anymore. So it's probably going to be by committee to some extent, unless you have that breakthrough year from somebody. And then we'll be talking about that guy a lot, because then that'll be a real exciting thing, like we had with some of the breakthrough guys in the Stanley Cup year.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us on Teal Town USA, Randy. You can find Randy on Twitter and on Instagram under the handle Shark Voice. Randy, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Guys, enjoy it. Keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for having me on. Enjoy the season, and won't be long now. Go Sharks.